Welcome to the future. I'm Mark Sackler. This is Seeking Delphi episode number 5, Teaching and Learning the Future. Just how does one teach or learn about something that hasn't happened yet? More than anything, it's a mindset. A mindset that understands the pace of change, that understands that change is driven by the social as well as the technological, that understands that actions have complex long-term implications that often are not immediately apparent, that there are almost always unintended consequences. I personally am on a mission to disprove the old adage that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. At an age when most people are retiring, I'm going for a master's and embarking on a second career as a futurist. But I do submit that learning in the seventh decade of life is far different than it is in the first few. One may have to work harder to make new knowledge stick, but one also has the advantage of experience, which can be used to make new knowledge more applicable. That in itself is a driving force in this podcast. I was a broadcast journalist in my youth. But before I digress too far with personal notes, let's cut to the chase of today's two interviews. My guests are a professional futurist who is teaching about the future to the youth of the world, and a gamer who is using a rather old-school approach to experiencing the implications of future thinking. We begin with my interview with Dr. Peter Bishop, founder of Teach the Future. Peter, welcome to Seeking Delphi.
It's nice to be here, Mark. Thanks for calling.
To begin with, tell us a little bit about your personal background as a futurist and how you got to where you are now to teach the future.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I woke up at 5 years old and always wanted to be a futurist, but I became a futurist by total dumb luck. I was in the seminary in college and got a degree in philosophy. And was going to be a physicist, but 1968-69 happened instead. And I found a lot more interesting things going on in society and in the street than in the physics lab, and I wasn't a very good physicist anyway. So I switched to sociology, got a graduate degree to study social change, and found out that I did some research on that. My master's thesis was on protests of students traveling to Washington to protest the war in Vietnam. But the sociology departments really didn't study much social change because it took too long. Couldn't get enough publications. I taught for 3 years, straight sociology, and then came to Houston, the University of Houston at Clear Lake, which was a brand new campus. And that campus had already established a degree, the first degree in the world, actually, in studies of the future. I was there to teach research methods and statistics. So I kind of knew the folks, I kind of hung out with them, and didn't realize until about 1982 or 1983 that I could actually teach some of this stuff, which I did. And I basically took over the program and ran that program for 30 years. So I'm a futurist by accident, certainly by choice, but it was nice landing at a university that had the degree already. Retired in 2013 and realized that all my work and the work of almost all futurists is with adults, which is fine. Adults need to know about the future. And of course, they're the ones with the money, so that's where people make a living. But nobody was talking to young people. Nobody was talking to high school students or college students about that. So I established a nonprofit corporation called Teach the Future, whose job it is to try and introduce futures thinking to school districts and to undergraduate colleges. So that's my full-time job right now.
Why teach the future in the first place? I'm sure you've been asked that a lot. We teach the past. Why teach the future?
Well, obviously, where we're going to live is in the future, though some people might prefer to live in the past. They're heading towards the future. It helps students prepare for change, for dealing with change. We believe that the increasing rate of change, which is fairly well documented largely through the internet and increasing communication and information transmission, is putting ideas together faster than ever was before. Issues are more complex. The world is more complex. Change happens more rapidly. So the old techniques of dealing with the future, which was essentially extrapolation using spreadsheets and data to work out what we expect is going to happen, is no longer sufficient. So we believe that students leave school with that impression, as we did, that you can kind of predict the future, but then they get into the real world and realize that they can't. So the way we approach the future is through scenarios, alternative futures, using critical thinking and a degree of creativity to an imagination to get an idea of what could happen, not necessarily what will happen. And finally, we also want to give students the belief that they can have some influence. They can make a difference in the world if they work at something, set a goal, and work towards it. So that's also part of what we teach the future.
To elaborate a little bit more on how you teach the future, could you talk to some of the tools and resources that you might use and how you might approach, for example, children of different ages?
Yeah, of course, everything has to be appropriate. We have a library online now. It's library.teachthefuture.org, and it has material all the way from elementary school material, which one of our colleagues posts those, all the way through college courses. And it is necessary, obviously, to deal with younger people differently. I taught graduate students for so long that, you know, talking to third and fourth graders is kind of a stretch for me, but there are a lot of people who do that very well. We have a school in Pittsburgh, in fact, where the principal and a teacher there has been teaching futures quite a bit, and we're kind of partners with them. So it's just a matter of making it simple. We're writing a book right now that will be aimed at middle school students, which are seventh and eighth graders, so they're 13 or 14 years old. And one of the most interesting books we use actually in our program, a book about systems thinking, was written in the 1970s by a colleague of ours who also wrote it for middle school students, though it's been used in colleges and in graduate schools and very, very advanced studies. But it's a great, simple, straightforward, very clear delineation of that. So we're hoping to have our book be the same thing, having to do with futures thinking, not so much systems thinking.
We talked a little bit about how things differ by age. I noticed that you have a European branch. Are there cultural differences in how you teach it and how people respond between the U.S., Europe, or other parts of the world?
There are some differences. Erica Boll is a futurist in the Netherlands, and she's been very active, created a nonprofit over there and has organized a lot of meetings and seminars. I'm not sure exactly. We're both struggling to get the future into classrooms. The classroom curriculum is pretty full, and teachers are not necessarily, they don't really know how to teach about the future. I didn't know how to teach about the future before I was taught by the faculty at the University of Houston Clear Lake. So it takes some getting used to. They have to learn kind of a new approach. I don't know that there's any real difference at that level. But of course, Americans and Europeans are culturally quite similar. Once you get into other cultures, say the Middle East, I've taught adult seminars in the Middle East, and there are some differences there. The kind of Western Enlightenment cause-effect relationships are not quite the same in that culture as it is in ours. I suspect that the Asian cultures would also have some differences there too, but we don't have a whole lot of experience teaching students in those cultures, so I really don't know what the cultural differences will be.
Speaking to the different ages and cultures, do you find that some of them may be more receptive than others to the old whole idea of future learning, teaching the future, learning the future?
Well, there are, I mentioned the Asian cultures. They seem to be, at least at the adult level, more interested in thinking long-term than the more flexible, the more responsive, perhaps, Western cultures do. I think there's a cultural difference there. They have a relatively much more stable type society, so they have to think long-term to create any change at all. American society and the West in general, as I said, tends to be a little bit quicker, a little bit more flexible, but therefore it also is kind of short-term in its orientation. But there's a future to next week, there's a future to next year, so it doesn't have to be, so it's better to be thinking long-term and making long-term plans. What we tell people is that they can create significant change, even by themselves or in their organizations, but they can't do it right away. They have to work at it. They have to be persistent and work towards the same goals, using whatever opportunities and tools present themselves, but the goal and the vision is always the same. I think those societies probably have a little bit more ability to do that than the U.S. or the European societies do.
What about ages, particularly future thinking does require some creativity since change is not always linear. It's often not linear. Do you find younger or older students more creative or more adaptable or not much difference?
Yeah, there is a general belief, and it's probably well supported in research, that young children are much more ready to be creative, to use their imagination. They're playing outside, making up stories, making up games, and playing with each other in that way. Adults don't seem to have that capacity. Whether that capacity goes away on its own as a developmental change as people grow up, or whether our society or even the schools reinforce knowledge as information as opposed to imagination, it's hard to tell what the source of it is. But yes, I think younger children tend to be more creative. Of course, they know less and they have less experience. So while they can be creative, they still have a hard time translating that into action, because creativity by itself does not really get the job done. So yes, more creative, and probably less so as they get older. We try and emphasize the creativity and the imagination part of the future in coming up with scenarios and alternatives and in presenting them. So stories and videos and images and things like that are definitely the thing we're trying to promote with young people, to try and preserve whatever creativity they have.
Let's ask one final question here, and that is just here in Western culture, since you're focused in Europe and the U.S., what would be an ideal long-term outcome for what you're doing in terms of creating more foresight in the schools?
Well, the long-term outcome, our vision statement, is we teach the future as we do the past, meaning that it's a very obvious routine. It's in every school. It's in every curriculum. We think of social change and time as a series of episodes. We call them eras, and we've studied those eras in the past. People forget that we're in an era today, and however you want to characterize it, it will be studied by historians and by students of the future. They'll look at us the way we've looked at past eras. So it's a story that has we don't have an ending yet. There's more to the story. The book is not over. The movie is not finished. So what we want to do is present students with three times in their experience, the past, clearly, the present, and the future as one whole story. Now, the future hasn't happened yet, so one has to use the tools that we use of extrapolation and consequential thinking, but also creativity and imagination to figure out the things that could happen, not the things that will happen, and to give them some agency that they can have an influence on the last part of the story, that it's not over. So it's a three-part timeline, not a two-part timeline. And that would be wonderful if 100 years from now, people actually thought about the future as still being part of the story.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Peter. Appreciate your time, and best of luck going forward.
My pleasure, Mark. Thank you for the opportunity.
More information on Teach the Future is available at teachthefuture.org. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn." Among the tools futurists use for developing a futures mindset are exercises of involvement, including simulations, role-playing, and games. One such futurist is Rob Maddox, whose Kickstarter project Hope City employs an old-school, low-tech gaming approach to learning about the future. I spoke to him last summer at the World Future Society's annual conference. Let's hear what Rob had to say. I'm speaking with Robert Maddox, the designer of Hope City. We're at the World Future 2016 conference, the annual meeting of the World Future Society at the Washington, D.C. Hilton. And I'm standing here looking at what looks like a typical classic board game. There are cards, dice, markers, but really, is it? Rob, tell me briefly what it is that I'm looking at here.
So, you are looking at kind of a designer board game. It's 4 years in the making. It's a cooperative game, so that's kind of a new thing. So you're working together as a team as opposed to competing against each other. But yeah, you're looking at a board game that was designed with the future in mind. So the future studies that I've done, the disciplines are incorporated into the mechanics, how the game is played, so that you're delving into all kinds of things like systems thinking, you're delving into strategic thinking, resource management. There's a bit of the wild card of the future, and then there's also the team dynamic as well.
All right, so I'm looking at right around the perimeter here. I'm seeing all these cards. I'm seeing entrepreneur, doctor, mayor, engineer, coach, ranger. These are kind of outside, sitting outside the board with markers in front of them. So explain to me what these are and how they're used.
So it's kind of like a real-life scenario, and these are citizens in the city. Each one has unique talents that they help the team with these. They have two to spend during the game, and they just have to be wise about when to use them. And then they also have this kind of weird dynamic where they get to make a decision that's a bit sketchy. It's a bit, you know, should you really do this? Like for the mayor, should she bribe? You know, we would say no, but sometimes taking a shortcut is seems like the best thing to do. So that mayor has a decision to make whether or not she is going to give into that that we call a temptation action and see if she can help the team in that way.
Now, I see these cards. I saw before that these cards have two sides to them. Explain these two sides.
Yeah, well, I think there's kind of a duality to humanity in the sense that sometimes we're good, sometimes we're bad, sometimes we make good decisions, other times bad decisions. In this game, if you take your temptation action, like the mayor, if she takes the bribe action, she has to roll a die to see if she can get away with it. And if she can't, if she rolls and she gets a corruption token, if she gets too much corruption in the game, then she's going to break bad, which is a familiar concept, you know? So the mayor becomes the mobster. You know, the doctor in the game becomes the drug dealer. And so they're still working with the team. They're still in the city. They're helping, but they're also hurting at the same time.
Okay, so let's explain to me some of these other factors. There's a bunch of different cards here. So you've got, looks like the standard steep categories. You've got social, economic, political, technology. Explain to me how those work.
Yeah, so these are basically the objective cards in the game. So the citizens have to complete objectives, one objective for each sector of society. So one objective of politics and so forth. Now these cards are basically, like you said, steep, you know, are understanding the future. But it's the way we have it ordered is pesty, because some things in life are pesty. They bother you. And so this game is bothering you. It's attacking you. It's corrupting you. It's chaotic. So it's a it's kind of a little bit of a twist there. But, yeah, there's basically just objectives you have to achieve during the game.
Okay, and then on the board I see, what is that, chaos, and I see hope. They kind of remind me of the kind of the chance cards in Monopoly, but I have a feeling they're a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, the chaos cards are basically like life. You know, sometimes we have our own objectives that we're trying to achieve, but sometimes objectives are imposed upon us. So chaos is the threat that's overlooming the city for an entire year. And if you don't deal with it as a team, if you don't take care of the scenario, then the bad thing is going to kick in. So it's like infrastructure. If you don't build up your infrastructure, then you're going to be hurting businesses and you're going to be hurting the city long run. So it's that kind of thing. The hope cards are basically game changers in that they're wild. So when you complete an objective, you get to take a hope card, and then this you can use for later when it's crucial, when it's, you know, key opportunity.
And finally, explain to me what I'm seeing on the rest of the board itself. I'm seeing Trade Center here. I'm seeing business expansion, and I'm seeing what kind of look like the equivalent of what you'd see of hotels in Monopoly, but they're little wooden figurines is what they look like on all the steep categories. And then I'm seeing future down at the bottom here.
Yeah. So the main thing is your citizen is represented by this little wooden thing that you're talking about. It's called a meeple. Instead of people, it's a meeple. And there's five city spaces, basically, that coincide with the five sectors. You're seeing the trade center, basically, is where the resources are that you need to complete the objectives. And so the trade is, you know, you can go and get what you want if you trade something else for it. The business expansion is the cooperative element of the game. So you start out not being able to cooperate on the level zero. And in the game, you have to work so that you can bump that up to level one. And on level one, that means you can cooperate with one other person as long as you're on the same city space with them. And then you can get up to level two where you cooperate with two people. So that's the cooperative element. And then the future track is basically it's empty rectangles that spell out future, the size of a card. And it's there's a card placed on the letter T in the beginning of the game. Now, which that means your objectives get placed into the future if you can't accomplish them in the moment. So that means you can plan ahead. And so when they're in the future, you look ahead and you're like, okay, I'm going to plan for that. But the future is closed. You can only put two cards there. So you want the future to be more open. You want that card to slide down to the letter E so you have five spaces instead of two spaces to put your cards. You want to have more time to plan. But it doesn't always work out that way, and sometimes the future closes, and then you can't put any cards there, and you begin to fail.
Okay, and what is the trade center?
Yeah, the trade center is basically where the resources are, and that the resources that you have, you can trade there to make sure that you get the ones that you need to achieve the objectives.
And then what ultimately is the objective? How do you, I'm assuming ultimately there's a win or a lose. There's a, you get the ultimate gold ring at the end or you don't. How does that work?
So yeah, the citizens have 7 years to make their city a thriving city. And so the way we've gamified that is that you have to put out city sites. You know, so if you're in society, you think of a city site would be not necessarily a tourist attraction, but something that is useful to the society, which would be like a school. So, in politics, it would be City Hall, and economics would be like the bank, and technology would be like the lab, and then the environment would be like a park, something that's useful to the city. And so basically, as citizens, you have to put out 3 city sites during the course of 7 years to win. And if you don't, then you lose. So it just comes down to making your city, useful and thriving.
All right, so let's get on to some peripheral issues outside the game. What is the ultimate background motivating factor that made Rob Maddox, inspired Rob Maddox to do this?
So yeah, I've been thinking about the idea of hope for about 20 years now. So I named my daughter Hope, and she's 18 now. I've been thinking about this, and kind of this tremendous force in human nature to accomplish seemingly impossible things that people strive for. So in that study, I began to, I didn't really have any tools to really understand the future or to really understand what hope is and how it works and how, when you're depressed, you can get hope. So I began to do some study. I traveled, went to Latin America to see, to experiment with hope in impoverished areas. Finally landed myself at Regent University, where I was able to study, strategic foresight. And then I took my own discipline of hope and began to kind of investigate the positive psychology movement. Not pop psychology, but positive psychology, which is basically not the study of, hey, why are we so depressed and angry and messed up, but what makes us thrive? What's exciting about us? What do we, how do we find grit and joy and happiness and all that? That's a big trend. So I got the tools to understand what hope is all about. And then when I really got a grasp on it, I thought that my mission in life is to make hope tangible. So I wrote a book. That's great. But I couldn't think of anything more tangible than a board game to spread the message of hope, to teach people about the future and get that out there.
Great story. So the final question then is, tell me about the business aspect of this, how you are planning to proliferate this out there to the masses that need foresight.
Yeah, this is a very exciting time for people who are doing board games because, in the past, you're trying to submit to a publisher and, your success rate is maybe 5% that you're going to get published. So, and then even if you do, you're going to make such little money and your design's going to be changed. So you really lose your artistic license, but now is a great time because there's a platform out there called Kickstarter. Kickstarter, if you don't know, is a crowdsourcing platform online. And basically, you put out your project and you say, hey, this is what I want to do. Hey, will you pledge to help me get it done? If you do, I promise to give you a copy of the board game. So, we're hoping for at least 600 backers, people at $39 a pledge, and then we're going to send them a copy of Hope City Game.
Sounds like a great idea. Best of luck to you, Rob.
Thanks, Mark. Great talking with you.
You can follow Hope City on Facebook and see what it looks like in a YouTube video embedded in the blog page for this program. In the news this week, speaking at the World Mobile Conference, SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son said that by 2050, our pale blue dot will be home to 4 billion more super smart robots than people. He also forecast 1 trillion devices connected to the Internet of Things by 2040. McDonald's announced a new approach to ordering to go, one that could eventually spell the end of its iconic drive-through windows. The plan is to enable mobile ordering with curbside delivery, and they hope to have it in operation by the end of this year. In the short term, this may require hiring more staff to bring those orders out to your car. In the long term, it's just one more job for robots to usurp. And finally, Elon Musk, it seems, is not to be outdone by anyone. After the Russian space agency announced that it would send tourists on a trip around the moon by 2022, Musk's SpaceX announced it would beat them to the punch and do it late next year. They claim that 2 tickets have already been sold for the first flight on a Dragon capsule that has not yet even had an unmanned test. And all of this for a reported $35 million measly dollars apiece. I think I'll pass. Links to all of today's stories are available on the Seeking Delphi website. Don't forget that you can subscribe to these podcasts on iTunes or on YouTube, and can follow us on Facebook. My technical advisor, as always, is Mohammed Marouf. Theme music is licensed by Pond5, and I do everything else. Until the next time, I'm Mark Sackler.